Yeah, I'm very happy to, of course, come from 10 meters from here and tell you about some work that have been recently finished with Davide, who is in the audience, and also Anson Hook, who is a professor in Maryland. So today I will be telling you how to look for new minimums in the landscape. In particular, I will present you an example where we look for a new Higgs minimum with cosmodule collider physics. So I will explain why we care about looking for new minimum, what is the Higgs story, and also what is cosmodule collider physics. Okay. So to get started, let's coming back to one of the main questions that we are interested in particle physics, that is the hierarchy problem. So there are two hierarchy problems. One is the electroweak hierarchy problem, which is the question, why is the Higgs so much lighter than the Planck scale? And also there is the cosmodule constant problem, which is concerns the smallness of the cosmodule constant, or the Hubble scale, why the Hubble scale or the size of the universe is so much different from the Planck scale. So people have known these problems for a very long time and come up with resolutions or solutions. So there are two main types. The first type is using a symmetry, something like a supersymmetry, to protect the Higgs mass from receiving quantum corrections, and as a result, make it natural. So the second type of solutions involves the introduction of the string landscape, the idea of the multiverse, and the anthropic reasoning. And the reasoning goes as following. So unless these parameters are as small as we observe them, the universe won't behave like what we experience. We won't be able to exist. And of course, we won't be able to see these numbers if they are very different from what we observe today. Okay, so we have been exploring both directions for many, many years. And quite recently, we have built the LHC, and the LHC has given us a lot of data, which kind of blocks the direction of naturalness. Because none of the particles that we proposed are actually found at the LHC. And in some sense, the LHC is like a very solid wall that blocks us from accessing a natural, beautiful world behind it. So in this talk, I will be telling you about some exploration we had in the last year in the direction of the multiverse. So we are not the first one to explore the direction of the multiverse. There has been a lot of explorations under the philosophy that knowing it, its meaning the multiverse, could be out there, could exist, is in itself very important information, and it should guide model building. So most important and famous example is Weinberg's solution to the cosmodule constant, where he relates the smallness of the cosmodule constant and the Hubble scale with the existence of galaxies. So what he realized that the galaxy formation requires a long enough period of matter domination. And if the cosmodule constant is too big, then our universe evolution will transition directly from radiation domination to CC domination. So galaxies won't be able to form because density perturbation won't be able to grow, and we won't be able to live in a galaxy and observe the beautiful universe that we live in today. So that's Weinberg's solution. And since then, we have had many new developments. For example, string axiverse and spread supersymmetry, where people in the audience has worked on. And all of these analyses point to some indirect evidence that we can look for, which will tell us about the possible existence of a landscape by observing either a lot of particles or particles that are some particles that are lighter than others expected. So here today, I want to tell you about something that is one step further compared to this analysis following the philosophy, which is that we want to see if we can look for a new minimum in the landscape directly. And a new minimum is the deciding feature of the landscape. And if we see one or a few minimum in the landscape, then it is a very strong evidence that we are living in the multiverse. So since last year, we have come up with two examples. The first one is by searching for these localized bubbles, which I'm happy to tell you about after the seminar. And today I will be focusing on the second example that we found, which is to look for high-scale Higgs minimum that we can potentially populate in the early universe. Okay.
By the way, seeing just one more unit minimum is very far away from seeing 10 to the 500.
That's true. But like once you see one minimum, it kind of tells you that you need to already think very hard about the measure problem because you can be in one or the other, and it is not really 50-50. So then like in some sense it changes to me like it changes what's the most important question that we need to answer like in terms of networks. Okay. Yeah, so here let me give you the outline of the talk. So first I will be telling you about the Higgs story, which is what the Higgs was doing during inflation and reheating, how Higgs explores the minimum structure of its own potential. Then I will be telling you about the behaviors of the Standard Model fermions, and how they are produced during inflation and contribute to the signal that we want to measure. I will show you some of the results and make some remarks. And in the end, I think I will have time. I will tell you about something that is complementary to the main story that I will be telling you today, where we see how different some of the other Standard Model particles contribute to cosmological collider signals that we can look for. So to start with, let me tell you what the Higgs is doing. So before getting into the details of what the Higgs is doing in our particular case, let me introduce you briefly the observation of a Higgs instability. So the Higgs instability is the observation that the Higgs quartic coupling, which is the only coupling that is not multiplicatively renormalized, and as a result, it can change sign, depends on the energy scale, actually change sign at some high energy scale around 10 to the 11 GeV. Okay, so what it means is that the electrically weak minimum, so the one here that we are living in today, is only metastable. It is not stable because there can be some region of the Higgs potential that is much lower energy compared to the minimum we are living in today. And as a result, we can tunnel out of the electrically weak minimum into this new minimum or wrong away direction today. It is, we are metastable, meaning that such a tunneling rate into the new minimum is very, very small. So the lifetime of the universe in the electrically weak minimum today is going to be way bigger, longer than the age of the universe. So in some sense, we don't need to worry about it today. But if we look back in the history of the universe, in particular, if we go back all the way to the time period of inflation, if the inflationary Hubble scale is large enough, then the Higgs will receive a lot of, will get a lot of quantum fluctuation in its minimum. It will jump around, and it can easily leave the electrically minimum by going above this barrier, which is at a field value that is much smaller than the Hubble scale during inflation. Okay? So people have known this for a long time and studied its consequences. So there are a few things that it could imply. If we confirm Higgs instability and observe, let's say, high-scale inflation. So first thing that I can imply is there are new physics at the weak scale or low energy scales. So you introduce some new particles that couple to the Higgs, and these particles, through their interaction, is going to change how the quartic coupling of the Higgs actually runs, You can make it always positive, no matter what is the energy scale. And as a result, you will be the electrical minimum will be completely stable. So, yeah.
This statement, why does it have to be an electrical scale?
It can be any scale.
Anywhere below 10 to the
11. It can be any scale, yes. Yeah. But like usually people try to relate it to the hierarchy problem, which is why they try to introduce something at a very low scale. So there is also the second possibility, which is coupling the Higgs to the inflaton or to the curvature, and that lifts the Higgs potential only during inflation through these couplings. And if you introduce a strong enough coupling, then you get a correction to the Higgs potential during inflation from this coupling, and then it can also make the electric weak scale minimum completely stable even during inflation. So today I will be telling you about a third possibility, which is kind of more minimal, which is where we want to ask the question, can we be living in this second minimum of the Higgs all along during inflation? We don't introduce anything like at a scale that is comparable to the scale where like V equals zero or below. And the answer is yes. And that is the new Higgs story that we found. Okay, so what happens is first during inflation, the Higgs, as I said, is going to fluctuate. It can fluctuate over over this point where V lambda equals zero, and slowly roll down to its high scale minimum. Once it rolls down to the minimum, it will still there the whole time when the scale VUV is much bigger than Hubble. And all that, all what it requires is that there is actually a high scale minimum, which can be generated from some quantum gravity correction or string and gradient unification contribution that stabilize the runaway direction for the Higgs. Okay. Of course, today we do not live in this high scale minimum, right? So there must be some way that to bring us back from this high scale minimum to the electric weak one. Okay. And that is actually provided very simply and very naturally by the thermal contribution from the Stein model bath after reheating. Okay. So what happens is that when reheating happens, the Stein model particles are all getting reheated, and the thermal bath of the Stein model particle is going to provide a correction to the Higgs potential. The thermal potential of the Higgs is going to favor the point where V equals zero, because that's the point where all the particle is the, in the center model is the lightest.
Separate question about yep. The first part. I mean, if the energy scale of inflation is high enough that the field is exploring potential between the two minima and everywhere in between, it's not like the whole universe would be stuck on the right. It would be stochastic distribution.
So that's the requirement here. So if your UV value of the Higgs is much bigger than Hubble, then like once you reach this point, the mass of the Higgs at this point is very large. Okay, when the value is large, you have some like order one quartic. Then like the mass of the Higgs around this point is very large. So once you reach there, you cannot quantum fluctuate out anymore because Hubble scale is much smaller than the Higgs mass in this minimum. Yes, because the VAV here is much bigger than the value of the Higgs value value of the Higgs at the point where quartic is equal to zero.
Can you show that the volume distribution that point is an attractor, that the point around the minimum is an attractor?
We can compute like the mass of the Higgs in this minimum, depending on the VAV.
Can you show that the distribution of volumes, if I take some?
Yes, because it will.
Where I start in the left?
Yes, yes.
At late times, all the yes. Volume is in the right?
Right, because once you like quantum fluctuate over this barrier, you will like end up like in this minimum like very quickly. And the energy scale between these two points is very small compared to the energy scale that is actually in the inflaton potential. So like the universe expansion is not very much modified depending on where you are in these two
places.
So you
require a minimum number of E-folds?
It only takes one E-fold.
One E-fold?
So once you go over the barrier, after like one quantum fluctuation jump, the rest of it is all classical evolution. You will just roll down this potential. And the rolling down takes less than a Hubble time. It's like a fast rolling because the mass of the particle there is actually very large. OK? All right, so yes. Let me get back to this point part. So the Higgs potential is going to receive some thermal correction, and the potential will look like the red line. The Higgs is going to start here and roll back to the point where V equals zero. It's going to roll back while at the same time interacting with the Snell model radiation, the Snell model bass. And through these interactions, the amplitude of the Higgs are going to quickly decay, and all of the universe is going to end up in the electroweak minimum. And all that requires is that you have a reheating temperature that is large enough compared to the value of the UV bevel of the Higgs. Okay? So when does this happen? Here I show you the parameter space of our model. So there are two parameters in our model. One is the valve of the Higgs, the UV valve of the Higgs, and the other parameter is the Hubble scalar inflation. So we know that there are constraints coming from the measurement of tensor to scalar ratio during inflation, coming from inflation, and that gives you a bound on R, which also bounds the Hubble scale to be less than 6 × 10⁻³ GeV. So all of this region to the left of this green line is not really a part of a parameter space, because a new minimum coming from some higher dimensional operator can only exist in places where quartic is negative, right? So within this region, the quartic is always positive, so you only have the electroweak minimum anyway. Okay. So this is not part of the real parameter space. The only requirement that we get for this story is this constraint, which is this red triangle. And within this red triangle, the reheating temperature that you can reach after inflation is not going to be high enough to rescue you from the UV minimum. In all of this wide region, the story that I was telling you would apply.
Have some much steeper stabilization there?
It doesn't. As long as like the stabilizer is coming in as some high dimensional operator, then everything is the same. Once the thermal correction comes out, that term is not important.
And actually, it's also quite insensitive to anything that you put between the electroweak scale in 10⁻¹.
Yes.
Because as long as the potential is not very high, who cares?
Right? Yeah.
So the lines that you have there. Vertical lines that you have there, no instability there, instability there. That, like, it's very easy to build a model where you have the instability. You put something, some variables, you make it unstable, and then all your parameter space opens up, right?
That's right. Yes. So here, like, I'm assuming it's just the standard model at low energy scales. Of course, you can also like use this part of the parameter space if you introduce some new physics.
Right?
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, in the last part, I told you about what the Higgs was doing, and it will mean very little if we don't have a way to look for it. So here, in the second part, I will introduce to you the toolbox, which is called the cosmological collider physics, that can be used to look for heavy particles during inflation, and how we can use it. To look for some Snell model fermions. Okay, so as the last part, I will start with some simple, some brief description of some more simple knowledge about primordial perturbations. Okay, so in the CMB and large scale structure, and also in the future 21 centimeter. One of the main things that we measure that can tells us a lot of information is primordial perturbations and their correlation functions. So in particular, today we will be working with correlation functions in momentum space. In particular, we will be working with three-point functions, which are basically functions where I have three zetas and in momentum space. And the three zeta will have momentum that forms a triangle like this. So the zetas always have momentum that forms a complete like a triangle because of translational invariance. Okay, so the simplest primordial perturbation correlation is power spectrum. Okay, and it is very easy to compute. You can compute it with a diagram like this, where the dashed line are the inflaton, the black line is the time where tau equals zero, which you can think of as the end of inflation. And you can compute two-point functions for the inflaton with diagrams like this, and then translate it into two-point functions of density perturbations in momentum space and position space, which you can think of as correlation functions at the time where tau equals zero. So of course, the power spectrum contains very limited information, because as you can see, if we want to compute the power spectrum, all we need to do is put a propagator. So, and a propagator doesn't have much information about the interactions of the inflaton. So in order to get more precise information, or like more rich information about what is actually happening during inflation, we need to go to higher power functions, and those are called the non-Gaussian entities. So in particular, here I show you the three-point function, which people usually call bispectral. So with three-point functions, you can test interactions between the inflaton. And for example, if you look at this diagram here, then we can look use three-point functions of density perturbations to look for an interaction between the inflaton phi q. So all of this information about how this interaction actually looks like is encoded in this function S, which we will call the shape function. You can think of as the shape of the non-Gaussian entity. And these shape functions will contain information about what is actually happening during inflation. Okay. So cosmological collider is a particular type of non-Gaussian entity. And it concerns the case where there are not only massless particles, but also massive particles during inflation. So here, by massive particle, I mean particles whose mass is comparable or larger than Hubble. In that sense, inflaton, so it can be very, very heavy, is a massless particle during inflation. So the main effect of a massive particle comes from the fact that massive particles redshift differently from massless particles. So when you have diagrams like this one, and diagrams which contain a massive particle, which is this solid red line, and interfere them, then you at late time, you will get an interference pattern. And in momentum space, it shows up as an oscillating pattern in the squeeze limit, where the squeeze limit, I mean that one of the momentum of the inflaton or the density perturbation is much smaller than the other two, which are comparable to each other. So in this limit, the shape function can be simplified to a form like this, where it depends on two parameters. One is the amplitude of the signal, which we'll call FNL clock. And the other one is the frequency of the loss oscillation. And these are the two parameters that we'll compute for our particular signal, which will contain most of the information that we want to measure. Okay. So in the last half an hour, I gave you a lot of theory. Now let me show you some experiments to relax a little bit. So here, I want to introduce you to you where the name cosmological collider come from, and how we view it as a way to use the universe as a detector to look for what is happening during inflation. So here I show you two detectors. On the left is the CMS detector, and on the right is basically our universe. So in a collider event, what happens is you have some collision, which produce a bunch of particles, and which are registered in all layers of the detector. First, you have the tracker, tracking system, then you have the colorimeter, and then much further, you have muon chamber. Okay? And these work together to help you reconstruct what is actually happening in the middle. So it is very similar in the case of the cosmodule collider. So here is the detector for a cosmodule collider, which is our, as I said, our universe. And the collision point is basically what is happening during inflation. So the inflationary perturbation sees the primordial perturbation that we can observe today. And that's basically what is the collision. Okay? Of course, in our universe, it only collides once. The particles or the primordial perturbations is going to come out as the universe expands. And the first layer of detector that we can look for these, see this primordial perturbation is the CMB. Okay? By measuring correlation functions at the CMB, we discover some of the correlation functions that we get from inflationary perturbations. The universe will continue to expand to a period where we call dark ages, where we can use 21 centimeter to look for correlation functions. So compared to the CMB, which is a 2D map, and it's also a very clean map, where like all the primordial perturbations are somewhat linear, when we get to the 21 centimeter, it requires much more work to actually extract the information. And in some sense, it looks like the colorimeter compared to the tracker. So the universe will continue to expand until at some point we get our galaxies, right? And galaxy clusters. We still have a lot of the information from primordial perturbation, but of course, the universe has gone through some period of nonlinear evolution, and the information, in some sense, it is harder to extract all the information you want from measurement of galaxies. Because we need to rerun this nonlinear evolution back in time. Okay. So these are all the observations that we can have see what is actually happening during inflation. And it is very exciting if we can actually use our universe as a way as a detector to look for what is actually happening during inflation. Okay. So now that I tell you what we can use to.
Your signatures are going to be all linear.
Hmm?
All your signatures are going to be large scales enough that they are linear? Or?
It will be linear, but we'll see that 3D map help like very much compared to 2D maps because of the fast oscillation that I will show you later. Yeah. So yes, so now like I introduced to you like the very interesting new observations that we can have. Let's see like what is the thing that we want to measure and how we can use, in particular we want to see how we can use the cosmodule collider to discover this new minimum. And to do that, we'll be mainly looking for stem model fermions. So there are many ways why we like fermions. The first way, a reason, is because stellar model fermions have masses that scan many order of magnitude. So from the top quark to the electron, you get stellar model fermions with masses that span 6 order of magnitude. And these fermions, as we will see, will work as a comb to scan the Hubble scale. So the second thing why fermions are better is because fermions themselves don't have a hierarchy problem. Meaning that even if I introduce a strong enough, a very strong coupling to the fermion, to the inflaton, we are now going to totally destroy all the information that is in the fermions. Their masses, for example, is now going to be modified through quantum corrections. So there is a third reason why we love fermions, which is that fermions enhance electrolyte symmetry breaking. And I will tell you more about this when we get to the second part of the talk. Okay? So now we decided that we love fermions. Let's see how we can use them. So first, we need to introduce some interaction between the fermion and the inflaton. Without an interaction, of course, there's no physical effect that you can look for. So here we write down the lowest dimensional shift symmetric coupling that we can write down between the inflaton and the Stern model fermions, which you should look familiar to you because it is basically the same coupling between axions and the Stern model fermions. Once we write down this coupling, we can draw this diagram here where we use one loop diagram of the fermion to contribute to three-point functions of the inflaton. Okay. So of course, I'm now going to compute this diagram in this talk. It is very complicated. Instead, I will be telling you about the essential qualitative features that shows you how the signals that we'll be looking for would look like. And in particular, I will be telling you what the fermions, Stern model fermions, are doing from their production all the way to their annihilation. Okay. So the first thing that you observe once you introduce this coupling is that once you put the system in the background during inflation, where the inflaton is actually rolling, meaning that phi dot is non-zero, then the breaking of the Lorentz symmetry of the inflaton sector is going to communicate to the Stern model fermions. And this show up as a correction to the dispersion relation of the fermions during inflation. Okay, so here, instead of omega squared equals k squared plus m squared, depending on the helicity of the fermion, the dispersion relation is going to receive some corrections by this parameter lambda, which parameterizes how much you break Lorentz symmetry. So before I go forward, let me just stress that this lambda parameter is dimension one, which is against what people usually think. Okay. So here the dispersion relation I show you in the limit, where this parameter lambda is much bigger than the mass of the particle, which is much bigger than the Hubble scale. Okay. So with this dispersion relation, we can ask what are the fermion modes that are actually produced. Okay. So the mode that is produced, most likely to be produced, are the modes which has the lowest energy. And here, if you look at this dispersion relation, in particular the one with the minus sign, then you can have particles with very small frequency, very small energy, order m, but a momentum that is order lambda, which is way bigger than the mass. Okay, and this is important when we compute the production rate and the effective density. Okay, so the production rate of a fermion or of any particle during inflation can be computed via the standard non-adiabatic particle production, where the production rate is proportional to exponential to minus omega squared over omega dot. Okay. If you are familiar with the preheating, then that is basically the standard formula of e to the minus m squared over m dot. So, so in our case, because we are producing particles with a large momentum and a small frequency, when I change the time a little bit, meaning that I redshift the dispersion relation a little bit, the k changes a little bit, but once the k changes, because lambda is much bigger than m, the omega is going to change much more significantly with a small change of time. And that it means that omega dot is much bigger than usual. And when we actually do the computation, we find that the exponential is instead of m over h, which you will think of as the Boltzmann suppression, like m over the temperature. Here, the exponential suppression becomes e to the minus m squared over lambda h. This is important because it allows you to produce particles that are much heavier than the temperature of the system, Hubble. Okay? As long as the scale lambda is much bigger than Hubble. And you will see that it helps us to get a large signal because we can use one fermion to scan a much larger range of Hubble scale. We will see that explicitly in a figure. Yes.
When you compute these diagrams like this,
yes,
you integrate over all, you know, tau 1, tau 2, and tau 3.
Yes.
And when you integrate over these, is it always dominated by the latent time of that integral?
So
are you sensitive to the number of e, is it somewhere in here the number of e foldings enter as
no.
something you're very sensitive to? No.
No.
So
no.
You're dominated by the latent time, the last few e foldings.
Not necessarily like last few e-folding. Like you basically have like a relation, like in the integral, you will find like a relation between tau n and tau 3. So like you will see like the particles, if they are produced early, they will annihilate also early. And they will contribute to like when we look today, like a different, well, different length scales. But like as, but like, it is only depending on the ratio of the length scales when it is produced and when it is annihilated. Okay. All right. Okay. Yes. Effective density. So now that we did the production rate, let's look at the effective densities. So here we are producing fermions back to back with a large momentum. So you can think of it as a Fermi surface, right? So with a Fermi momentum that is order lambda. So the effective density of particles that you are producing is by definition k squared over delta k, where k is order lambda and delta k is order m in the small mass limit. So compared to normal case, where the effective density you produce is going to be Hubble cubed, in our case, you get an effective density that is enhanced by lambda squared by this large momentum as well. Okay, so after the fermions are produced, they start to redshift. The moment, and by redshifting, I basically mean that the momentum is going to slowly go to zero. Unlike a normal case where as the momentum goes to zero, the frequency also goes to zero. Here, when the momentum is decreasing, if you look at this dispersion relation with a minus sign, then the frequency is actually going to increase because the fermions are extracting energy from the rolling inflaton. So, and this weird or like a uncommon like a redshift is going to set, is going to show up in the oscillation frequency of K3 over K1 in the squeeze limit because during most of the redshift of the fermion, the frequency of the fermion or the energy of the fermion is order lambda and that sets the oscillation frequency of the signal that we are looking at.
What is the squeeze limit?
Squeeze limit is when K3 is much smaller than K1, which is comparable to K2.
And when you write lambda tilde or m tilde, those are lambda over h.
Oh, yes, yes. Sorry. Like everything with a tilde is that parameter in Hubble units. Thank you.
Why is it important that it's the squeeze limit?
Huh?
Why is it important that it's squeeze?
Well, first, like it is easier to see things in the squeeze limit because, like, the. In particular, like the signal, like a form, like a greatly simplifies. Okay, so like if it is not a squeeze limit, you will find very complicated functions. But in the squeeze limit, as I showed you earlier, there are only two parameters: the amplitude and the frequency. And like for series, I think like that's the main reason why people care about the squeeze limit. Okay, so yes, so after the fermions redshift. At some point, they will annihilate with one another. So when they annihilate, the frequency is order lambda, the momentum is order zero. You can think of it as annihilation between two very massive particles. And when they annihilate into massless particles, which are these inflatons, it can only pair annihilate, giving you two inflatons, which is also the reason why everything I've told you about the fermions only contribute to enhancement of the bispectrum instead of the power spectrum. Okay.
Sorry, why couldn't I have drawn out the same thing but without the leg on the right hand side of delta phi?
This one?
Yeah.
So this is the production. The fermions are produced from like the inflaton perturbation as well.
Oh, I see.
Okay, so that's all I want to say about the fermion story. Let me show you some results.
Sorry, can I ask maybe dumb question?
Yes.
Sorry, why can't you just connect the two blue lines and emit one delta phi? Still the bispectral.
No, like you mean like only one like of this red?
Yeah, but that's
the then like you have two heavy particle, right?
Yeah.
And not into a massless particle. That cannot happen.
Ah, okay.
There's an additional thing which is that all of the lights in here are basically on shell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So first, let me show you the signal strength from one fermion. So you can compute the shape function. As I said, it depends on only FNL and this frequency in the squeeze limit, and you can compute the amplitude. Which has this very complicated form, but the important thing is the limits. Okay, so here I show you in this figure the amplitude of the signal as a function of m over Hubble, the mass in Hubble unit. So at small mass, you see that the signal arises as m cubed, and more importantly, it has this enhancement of lambda squared. As you increase the coupling, the strength of the signal become bigger. On the right-hand side, you see the exponential suppression, as I was telling you before. The exponential suppression comes in not at the scale where m over h equal to 1, which is normal case, but at a scale that is much bigger than that. Okay. So that's how you see that we recover the right expectation of how these signals should behave in various limits.
So, phi dot over lambda f squared is 120. Is there any reason to believe that this coupling should be order one? Because phi dot comes from whatever is setting inflationary dynamics, and this is just a separate coupling that I've written in. Why is there a reason that I should expect that lambda f isn't much larger?
Oh, yeah, yeah, like you can have like a lambda f much bigger, then like the signal is going to be smaller.
Okay, but there's no a priori reason that I would guess that this phi dot over lambda f squared is...
So like there's only one control parameter. So if you think about like the... so like all of these capital lambdas as all coming from some like a high energy new physics, let's say like a string scale, then you would expect the energy scale during inflation. These suppression scales are all of the same origin, they are the same value, then this ratio is roughly going to be your free slow roll parameter, which is order 0.01. Yep. All right. So here, let me show you the signal strength, but not only for one fermion, but all the standard model fermions put together. You can, so like this. The thing is basically the figure that you see in the previous figure, but rotated 90 degrees. Okay? So on the x-axis, again, like I have either this ratio or here, like basically lambda tilde, which parametrize how strongly the inflaton is coupling to the fermions. On the y-axis, I basically show you the fermion masses, but instead of m over h, I show you v over h, such that I can plot all the standard model fermions on the same plot. So from top to bottom, we get a contribution to the non-Gaussian entity from all kinds of standard model particles, from the lightest one, the electron, all the way to the bottom quark. And there are two take-home messages. One, no matter what is the scale v in Hubble unit, you will always have one or a few of the standard model fermions contributing to the signal. And the second thing, which we'll see to be important in the next slide, is that in much of this region, you will have multiple fermions showing up to contribute to the signal at the same time. So for example, if you look at the region here, then you will have the bottom quark, the tau lepton, and the charm quark all contributing to the signal at the same time. Okay?
What are reasonable values of FNL that are currently, like what are the current constraints on?
So here we have a particular type of signal. So we do not know like exactly what is the reach or the constraint on this particular signal. But roughly, for some of the shapes that people have already looked at in the CMB, the constraint is order 40 or order 1, depending on the shape. So we think that the signal might be very observable, and we are working with some people to get out like actually like what is the is going to be the reach. But Maurice just had a kid.
Huh? The pi dot over lambda f squared or something.
Yes.
That's just low row parameter times order one volume.
You can think of it that like that, yeah.
So that looks like that you need a large volume or something to
you need like a slight hierarchy between the energy scale during inflation and the energy scale that is suppressing your interaction. All right, so I said seeing multiple fermions at the same time is important. Let's see why it is important. So we don't only want to see some particles in the CMB or in 21 centimeter. We want to measure its properties. So the two parameters that we can get from this measurement is the amplitude of the oscillation and the frequency. From these two parameters, we can get two model parameters out of it, which is the mass of the particle in Hubble unit and the coupling between the inflaton and the fermions in Hubble unit. Okay, MW. So if we can see multiple fermions at the same time, then we can take the mass in Hubble unit of the two different particles and take a ratio. So here, the valve of the Higgs is the same for different standard model particle. The Hubble scale is the same, so both of these cancel. And all you are left with when you take this ratio is the ratio between your Kawa couplings. And your Kawa coupling is the thing that you can predict to very, very high precision to high as the energy scale as you want. And if you see a few pair of standard model fermion that shows up with the same ratio that resembles the ratio of the Yukawas, then you know that you've seen the standard model in the sky, and also it corresponds to a standard model that is living a different minimum, not the electroweak one. And that is how what I mean by it offers us a way to look for the landscape directly. Okay. So in the last 10 minutes, let me tell you about something that is closely related, which complements the work that we did before.
Extent is your signal sensitive to the fact that I don't have exactly a 2D surface at last scattering? Or if I look at my 21 centimeter,
yeah, so
I have some z direction smearing.
So I won't say in much detail. So let me just answer your question now. So in the CMB, we have a 2D surface, a 2D map, and now like I have an oscillating pattern, which is a 3D oscillation pattern, right, in the squeeze limit. So if we project this 3D oscillation pattern onto a 2D surface, then you quickly smear out the oscillations. And which is why we think the reach and the constraint you will get from the CMB is pretty poor. But in the 3D map, like 21 centimeter, you will be able to see the 3D oscillation pattern. And that is why we think like a 21 centimeter will be a better tool to look for the signal that we're proposing.
But still, like what I'm saying is, if you actually get a realistic 21 centimeter signal,
yeah,
there will be still smearing, right?
Yes.
You still have some.
Yes, that's why we want to find out.
Very fast. It's not clear that they don't.
It is in some sense fast, but like remember, like the oscillation is in the log of k ratios. So it's not really, really fast. It is kind of fast. And it is the exactly the reason like why we want to do like a more careful analysis. So it's like a k3 over k1 to the I mu, right? Like, so it's like e to the I mu times log of k3 over k1. Okay. So yes, so the last part. So before I tell you what we did in the last part, let me just show you again the parameter space. This is the same plot that you see in the beginning, just squeeze a little bit on the y-axis. So here, what I have been telling you is happening in this green region, where we can look for Snell model particles from the bottom quark to the electron. Okay. So there are three questions you can ask. I mean, to ask many of them. The first question is, what is happening in the rest of the parameter space? So the second question you can ask, well, like you told me about all the contributions from the bottom to the electron, what about the top? Right? The top quark is also a quark. Why don't we talk about that? And the last thing, last question, which will actually push us forward in our understanding of what's happening, is this one, which is the fact that you are producing Snell model particles. How do they back react on the inflaton and the Higgs potential? Okay, and that is the question that I will be answering in the next 10 minutes. So, let me just do something very naive, okay? So we produce some fermions with a density that is of order m lambda squared. So, and then we can ask how does this number density of fermions contribute to the Hamiltonian or the energy density in the universe? And that the Hamiltonian is going to be basically of order the mass of the particle times the number density, which when I expand it is going to look like the Yukawa coupling square, h squared, which is basically m squared times lambda squared. Okay, so if I have a system or if I have a particle which has an order one Yukawa, then this correction is somewhat important. It is much bigger than something that we care about a lot, which are these couplings between Higgs and the curvature. So by naively looking at this, you would say that, okay, so the Snell model fermions is going to induce, in particular the top quark, which has order one Yukawa, is going to induce a very important correction to the Higgs potential. And that is actually the case. And we compute these two diagrams in the pseudo space, which gives us this result in the small mass limit. So here, as you can see, as a correction looks very similar to what I show here in terms of the scaling, just with some additional factor, which is this one loop factor. So the important part of this potential is that it comes with a minus sign. Okay? So we know that thermal corrections always give you a positive contribution to the Higgs potential. But here, we are working with a non-thermal particle density. And as Andre pointed out 20 years ago, if you have a particle density parametrized by a chemical potential, and here the lambda really looks very similar to a chemical potential, you will get a potential correction to the Higgs that comes with a minus sign. That's indeed what we found. Okay? So, and this correction to the Higgs potential is going to be important, especially for the top quark. So you produce your particles, and they induce the correction to the Higgs potential. The next thing you know is that the Higgs does not want to live at the point where h equals zero anymore, so it wants to roll down. Okay. So, but the interesting part is as the Higgs is rolling down, the fermions are becoming heavier because the fermions are coupled to the Higgs through the Yukawa coupling. And when the fermions becomes too heavy, their particle production is going to be suppressed, basically coming from the same exponential that I showed you before. Okay, so just through the two couplings that we introduced, one is the fermion coupling to the inflaton, and the other one is the fermion Yukawa coupling. you will get to a very interesting dynamical equilibrium where between the particle fermion particle production and the Higgs dynamics. And this results in a Higgs potential that we computed explicitly to be in a form that looks like this, okay? Where you see the dependence on y squared lambda squared when the mass is small, and also this exponential suppression when the mass is big. Okay, so whenever we have a potential, we are a particle physicist, so we want to find its minimum. So we can compute the minimum of the potential, which depends only on the Yukawa and how strongly the inflaton is coupling to my fermions, with very small negligible correction coming from the fact that the Higgs comes with its own quartic. The correction here is usually order 1%. So up to 1% correction, what you establish is a relation between the mass of the fermion, y times v, in Hubble unit, and is the fermion coupling to the inflaton also in Hubble unit. Okay? So this is the relation that we get in the end. Why is that important? Well, as I told you earlier, the signal that we are looking for has an amplitude and frequency which are depending on two parameters, lambda tilde and m tilde. Now, what happens in this case is that these two parameters are related to each other. Once we know one of them, we will know the other. And this means that for this particular signal, both the amplitude and the frequency is depending on one parameter only. And that is shown explicitly in this figure where we plot the amplitude of the signal as a function of the coupling in Hubble unit. What this allows us to do is to use one particle, the observation of one particle, the top quark, to uncover this complicated dynamics by itself because of this relation between the amplitude and the frequency of the oscillation. And that is what is happening in all of this blue region that I showed here. So here and here. So in all of this shaded region, the minimum that you have for the Higgs potential is the dynamical minimum, and you will see the signal coming from the top quark. Below this blue solid line here, you will not only have the dynamical minimum, but also potentially have the new Higgs minimum at a very large Higgs with a valve that is much bigger. Okay. Where you can look for the signatures coming from the standard model fermions, the lighter standard model fermions. So, which one?
The one with the dynamical minimum.
The one with the dynamical minimum.
Yeah, what's the shape?
Why? You mean like this?
Yeah.
The shape it comes from. Let me explain like this shape to you. So here, what happens, what's important is that above this line, the particle, in particular, the bottom quark is going to become too heavy to be contributing to the signal, okay? That's when the exponential equals to one, right? Which is when like m and m squared and the lambda h is equal to one another. And that gives you a relation between m and Hubble scale. Okay, so that is basically where this relation comes from. And here, like it is a little bit more complicated, especially here, but that's basically the physics where the exponential that you have is equal to one. Okay? All right, so just coming back, in this region here, and actually in all of these regions, you can have both the minimum existing at the same time, and depending on which minimum you're in, you might see the signal coming from the top quark or the lighter fermions in the standard model. Okay, so that's all I want to say. Let me close with some remarks. So I think we showed for the first time that there are examples where we can use cosmological collider physics to uncover some deep dynamics during inflation. So here, by measuring the ratio between the masses that is contributing to the signal, the mass ratios, or like by looking for the relationship between the amplitude and the frequency of the signal, we can discover either a physical Higgs minimum or a dynamical Higgs minimum. So what this allows us to do is to use cosmological collider physics as actually as a tool to study physics beyond a standard model. And everything that I was telling you about today in the past hour only relies on one coupling that we introduced between the standard model fermions and the inflaton. So once we introduce that single coupling, inevitably we'll get some of the observable signatures that I was telling you today. And that's all I want to say. Thank you, and yeah. Yes?
I think it's fair to ask, you can probe right handed neutrinos.
Yes. Yeah. Right, like, but as I said in the last, in the remarks, what is important like for what we are doing is we can establish some like a relationship between some numbers I measure, right? Either the amplitude and the frequency, or like the mass of the two particles. And these will tell you what is actually happening. So we can also, we can of course like look for the right-handed neutrino, but like seeing it, like it is very hard to find a like a very convincing like evidence to tell you that is exactly the particle that you have seen, and which is why I like this, these examples better. Yeah.
And you have lepton number violation with this kind of if you couple this to the neutrinos.
Yes.
You can have lepton number violation.
Yes.
Generate lepton.
So like you will be able to generate leptons. Here, like I was talking about like the density, it looks very large, but like you should really be thinking of one particle per Hubble patch, or a few particle per Hubble patch. It's actually very small.
So coming back to your motivation.
Yes.
One of the nicest things about this model is the minimality. You know, within the standard model, you have the second minimum and you probe its existence.
Yes.
I wouldn't motivate it with the multiverse, which is the most controversial, you know, unliked. But it has nothing to do with it. It's just one single second minimum that's already in the standard model.
Yes, but like I think like that is the question that keeps me up at night. So
what, the multiverse?
Like whether we can look for like
I mean, this is a dead minimal.
Yes, yes, yes. But like I'm just saying like the reason like I call the second signature like a lower risk, lower reward, because like if you discover it, it is very, very interesting, but it does not really tell you like what is actually happening for the hierarchy problem. And I think like if you really discover a physical minimum, it forces you to think about measure problem. Maybe like your for me like it is a very strong evidence for multiverse as what is happening in our universe. Yeah, sure.
He's losing a big fraction of his audience. Just by the first slides.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If there are no more questions, let's thank the speaker.